So I'd like to wish everyone a happy Gaur Purnima. Bhadra Prabhu has requested that we discuss this verse, which is from the Adi Lila, chapter 1, text 6. So this is a deluxe verse, many lines in each syllable. We'll chant this a few times. This is, of course, from Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita by Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami, presented to us by Srila Prabhupada. Sri Radhaya Pranaya Mahima Kidrisho Va Anaya Eva Aswadyo Jena Adhuta Madhurima Kidrisho Va Madhya. Sokyam Chasya Mad Anubhavataha Kidrisham Va Iti Lovat Tat Bhava Adhya Samajani Sachi Garbha Sindho Hari Hindu Sri Radhaya Pranaya Mahima Ki Drisho Vanayaiva
Sri Radhaya
Sri Radhaya Pranaya Mahima Kidrisho Vanayaiva
Sri Radhaya Pranaya Mahima Kidrisho Vanayaiva
Sadhyo Jainadhuta Madhurima Kidrisho Vamadiya
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 Saukyam Chasyamadanu Bhavata Kidrisham Veti Lovat
Saukyam Chasyamadanu Bhavata Kidrisham Veti Lovat
Tadbhavadhyak samajani shachi garbha sindhau harindu Tadbhavadhyā samajani shachi garbha sindhau harindu Sri Radhaya Pranaya Mahima Kidrisho Vanayaiva
Sri Radhaya Pranaya Mahima Kidrisho Vanayaiva
Sadhyo Jainadhuta Madhurima Kidrisho Vamadiya
Sadhyo Jainadhuta Madhurima Kidrisho Vamadiya
Saukyam Chasya Madanu Bhavata Kidrisham Veti Lovat
Saukyam Chasya Madanu Bhavata
Tadbhavadhyak samajani shachi garbha sindhau harindu
Tadbhavadhyak samajani shachi garbha sindhau harindu
So, take it away.
Shri Radhaya Pranaya Mahima Kidrisho Vanayaiva
Shri Radhaya Pranaya Mahima Kidrisho Vanayaiva
Lady Chants, if everyone could please move forward because there's some people in the back that can't get in, but please stop just short of trampling me. So if everybody could please move forward, and the ladies also, if you could come this way. So any other ladies that would like to chant? Translation. Sri Radhaya means of Srimati Radharani, Pranaya Mahima, the greatness of the love. Kidrisha, what kind, va, or. So the first, maybe as I'm doing the synonyms, we'll just look at it. Oh, we're down to the synonyms. Okay. So the first, there's a question. Which is being attributed to Krishna. This is in the mind of Krishna. Kidrisha. Um, what is the nature, ki drisha? Actually, drish in Sanskrit means to see. It's the verbal root to see, from which you get the word darshan, seeing. And so ki is the question. So ki drisha literally means like of what look, like what does it look like? Ki drisha. What does it look like? What is its nature? So the first question in the mind of God, in the mind of Krishna, is what, literally, what is the look of, or what is the nature of mahima, the glory? Mahi, of course, from like the word maha, great, so mahima, the glory. What is the nature of the glory, pranaya, of the love of Sri Radha? What is the nature of the glory of the love, the greatness of the love of Sri Radha? So Krishna poses this question to himself. And then va, or, in other words, additionally, another point, anaya eva aswadya. Anaya, by this one, Radha, eva alone, aswadya, to be relished. Or what is the nature of aswadya, that which to be relished by her alone? There is something, there is a sweetness which she alone can relish. And so what is that? What is it that only Radha, uniquely among all souls, can actually relish? And jena, by which, by that love, adbhuta madhurima, a wonderful sweetness, adbhuta madhurima, kidrsha va, what is it? What is it like? Madhya, that sweetness which she finds in me. Sokyam chasya, and her happiness. Sokyam cha asya means a Radharani. Sokyam, the happiness cha, and asya of her. Mad anubhavata, from realization of my sweetness. Anubhava means perception or realization. So from perceiving me, from realizing me, from her awareness of me, kidrasham, what kind of happiness does she experience? And iti, thus, the word, it's actually va iti, which probably, let's see, va or iti thus. So iti in Sanskrit, va iti, which becomes veti, you can see there. Well, you can't see it because we're separated up there. Iti in Sanskrit ends a quotation. The way quotations are done in Sanskrit, generally in Sanskrit, they're only direct quotations rather than saying, he said that he was coming. They would just say, I'm coming, iti, he said. Direct quotation. So here, iti, the word iti, closes a quotation, means that everything that comes before this word is in quotation marks. And this represents the thought of Krishna. This is what's in Krishna's mind. And so iti lobhat, from lobhat, Prabhupada translates here as from the desire. Lobha also often means greed. Here it doesn't mean a mundane greed, but a very strong desire. So from this strong desire to answer all the questions which Krishna just posed, what's this like? What's that like? And what's this other thing like? So from a strong desire to personally experience all this, the Hari Indu, the Hari moon. Indu means moon. So this, of course, means Krishna. But there's a beautiful metaphor here. The moon comes out of the ocean. When the ocean of milk was churned, all kinds of wonderful products came out. And one of them was the moon. So here it said the Hari moon, Samajani, has taken birth, Sindho, in the ocean, just as the original moon came out of the milk ocean. The Hari moon has now taken birth in the ocean of the womb of Sachi Devi, Sachi Garbha Sindho. And he's taken birth, Tad Bhavadhyaha, Adya means enriched. Prabhupada translates it, richly endowed with emotions. Bhava is the word for emotions. The word bhava, of course, comes from the Sanskrit verb bhu, B-H-U, which means to be or to exist. So bhava literally means a state of being, state of existence, but it can mean, often does mean, an emotional state. In fact, we talk that way in English, we say like, boy, look at the state that he's in or she's in, meaning an emotional state. So, also in Sanskrit, bhava, literally a state of existence, often means an emotional state. And here, it's said that the Hari Moon, Krishna, richly endowed with bhava, tadbhava. Tadbhava means Radharani, a tad Radharani state, Radharani's emotional state. So richly endowed with that, the Hari Moon took birth from the ocean of the womb of Sachi. So, that's literally what the verse says. This verse and the previous verse are extraordinary verses that really establish for all of the followers of Lord Chaitanya some crucial philosophical, theological points that really are central to our spiritual understanding. So I'd also like to read the previous verse, 5. Is that right? Give you 2 for the price of 1, Bhadra. Because vertex 5 is also, it's extraordinary. It's really extraordinary. So here's the Sanskrit, then I'll read the English. Radha Krishna Pranaya Bhikatir Ladini Shakti Rasmat Vekatmanava Bibuvi Pura Deha Vedam Katavatel Chaitanyakyam Prakatam Aduna Tatoyam Chaikyam Aptam Radha Bhava Dyuti Radha Bhava Dyuti Suvaditam Naomi Krishna Sarupam. The loving affairs of Sri Radha and Krishna are transcendental manifestations of the Lord's internal pleasure-giving potency. Although Radha and Krishna are one in their identity, they separated themselves eternally. Now, these two transcendental identities have again united in the form of Sri Krishna Chaitanya. I bow down to him, who has manifested himself with the sentiment and complexion of Srimati Radharani, although he is Krishna himself. So this particular verse of Krishna's Kaviraj reveals an amazing perhaps the supreme instance of the philosophy of Veda Veda Tattva, Achintya Veda Veda Tattva. Because it said here, so we'll just follow this logic and then go back to this text 6. Oh, did we did read the translation, or we didn't?
No.
For 6? We didn't.
No, wrong.
Okay. I know, since many of you actually are not, many of you are actually literate, I'll read it for you. So, desiring to understand the glory of Radharani's love, the wonderful qualities in him that she alone relishes through her love, and the happiness she feels when she realizes the sweetness of his love, the Supreme Lord Hari, richly endowed with her emotions, appears from the womb of Srimati Sachi Devi as the moon appears from the ocean. So, going back to text 5, which, oh my God, it's times have changed. You don't need someone to rush frantically up to a blackboard. And, So could we go to the Sanskrit for text 5? Okay. So, again, trying to understand what is being said here about the appearance of Lord Chaitanya, about Lord Chaitanya's identity. The first statement is that Radha is Krishna Pranaya Bikritir, a transformation of Krishna's love. The love of Krishna, love for Krishna, or Krishna's own love. Radharani is a vikriti, a transformation of that love. And she is the Ladini Shaktir. She's Krishna's pleasure-giving potency. Asmat. from this, or therefore, ekatma navapi. This is eka atma. The ends in an au, atmanav. The v is just the u, which is Sunday. So it's a dual form in Sanskrit, like in the song of the six Goswamis, Vande Rupa Sanatana, that form where the words end in au, au, is just a dual form. It means not singular or plural, but dual. So this is just an extraordinary word, ekatmanav. I mean, you could just think about this for a very long time. Just this one compound word that it means that one, two souls. Literally. It's a, I think it's one of the most extraordinary words in all of our scriptures. Ekatmanav. Atmanav by itself means two souls, but two souls were one. If you think about this, this is really the essence of romantic love, which as a sannyasi, of course, I know all about. So, it's part of my preaching portfolio. So, if you think about this idea of Beda Veda, difference and Aveda, non-difference, difference and non-difference, and if we use an example from the material world, which the Acharyas do, they definitely compare love of Krishna to the attraction between a young boy and a young girl. So we're allowed to use that analogy, so we'll use it. If you think about it, love in general creates a Beda-Veda situation, especially romantic love. And this is the example the Acharyas give. If you think about intense romantic love, there really is oneness and difference. Two people who were separate individuals meet and, let's say, the most romantic possible version of this, fall in love as Atma mates, and so, at least as long as it's still working for them. There's this, what did George Harrison say, all things must pass, but if you if you think of a young boy or young girl, or not so young boy and girl, falling deeply in love, at least at that moment when they're experiencing it, it really is a reflection of spiritual love. And two people who were separate come together in a way so that they actually become like one thing. In fact, we say they're a couple. We use it singular. I think I said this before, they are a couple. And there's a real, it's not, how should I put it, you can't merely say that they're two separate persons. To say that they're merely two separate persons is actually not a complete description of the situation. They are separate persons, but there's a sense in which they're not separate persons. There's a sense in which, being united, it becomes a single reality. So, romantic love in this world is a, pardon the term, perverted reflection of that love of Radha and Krishna. So people, when they fall in love in this world, or believe they're falling in love, of course they have very high hopes, and they experience a euphoric state often, which sweeps them off their feet. And anyway, there are too many humorous remarks makes all this country. But the, so we think about this, in the spiritual world, you mean Radha and Krishna, it is a falling in love, so you find romantic love at its most intense state, at its highest pitch, at its most beautiful, and it just gets better from there. But again, the oneness and difference. Oneness and difference is, can perhaps best be understood by thinking about intense romantic love. Because after all, two people that, let's say, fall in love and feel as if they're somehow deeply united, not simply in a social sense, like we go places together, but psychologically united at some level in terms of their, just their consciousness. At the most basic level, there's a collective consciousness, so that there's in a sense one consciousness, which is the result of two persons. And yet there's, in a sense, there's one consciousness. So this oneness and difference would not, this oneness, this unity would not be possible. Of course, you could say that someone could simply say, no, it's just all illusion. There's nothing really to, this sense of oneness when a boy and girl fall deeply in love, there's nothing spiritual to be learned from this, it's just an illusion. That would be the impersonal philosophy. When we say that this world is a reflection of the spiritual world, the reflection does tell us a lot about the reflecting object. So that if you see a reflection of a tree in still water, say in a pond, then it's not a real tree, but it tells you a lot about the real tree. It really does give you an extremely accurate picture of a real tree. It gives you a very accurate picture of a real tree. And so, if we take this analogy seriously, then we could say that when people in this world fall deeply in love, madly in love, then even though there are certain problems which gradually manifest, like the enjoying spirit and the bodily concept of life and other minor difficulties, still, nevertheless, there is a sense in which it gives us an accurate picture. It gives us an accurate picture of spiritual love. It's a mixture. It's not merely illusion. If this experience of falling deeply in love were absolutely false, then we would be ultimately impersonal. If it actually had nothing to do with our pure state of consciousness and existence, then we would be ultimately impersonal. That's not the case. So going back to I want to connect your psychology and ontology. Psychology meaning your state of mind, basically, what's going on in your head, in consciousness. And ontology meaning the nature of existence itself. Apart from the particular state of mind that you're in, what is the nature of existence itself? And so I want to connect psychology and ontology in the sense that we are capable of experiencing this extreme oneness or unity, this very powerful, profound sense of being united with someone so that there's practically a single consciousness which emerges out of the combination of two separate states of consciousness, that this is possible. This can actually take place because ontologically, we really are one and different. So that the psychological state is simply an awareness of a real fact in the world, namely that our existence is one with the existence of other people and one with the existence of Krishna. So it's not merely a psychological state, it's actually an insight, it's a realization about the objective nature of reality. The problem, of course, in this world, which we now call home for some time, the problem is that in this world, the experience of falling deeply in love only partially gives us an accurate picture of reality. The sense of oneness with another person is actually true. It's actually real. The notion that this oneness is based on our bodies is false. And so in the material experience of falling deeply in love, there's something which is true and something which is false. However, in the case of Radha Krishna, and I should add, in the case of pure souls falling in love, which does happen according to our scriptures, it's all real. The experience is absolutely real because the oneness is based on a correct understanding of who each person really is. And it is not selfishness doing business as love. It's actually love. In this world, again, I mean, I'll tell a story from Prabhupada which illustrates that even the love we experience in this world is not simply false, because the truth is not impersonal. I was with Prabhupada in 1972 at New Vrindavan for the Janmashtami Vyas Puja / Bhagavad Dharma Discourse event. And Prabhupada was taking a massage outside, sitting on a mat, and I was sitting next to Prabhupada, and these two young little kittens were wrestling, playing together, and they grabbed each other, so they actually formed a ball. These two kids, and they formed this ball, and they began rolling around, and they rolled right onto Prabhupada's lap. Now, back in those days, among the various hyper-zealous views that we held in our attempt to live in Vedic culture, one of them was that animals are not exactly evil. But hopelessly contaminated. So that if you touch an animal, you almost had to get a skin transplant. So when these kittens rolled onto Prabhupada's lap, I was horrified. I thought, oh my God, the utterly profane has touched the utterly sacred. So I was lost in this, I don't know, sort of bizarre religious consciousness. But Prabhupada, to my great surprise, acting like a normal human being. Prabhupada actually reached down and just started petting the kittens. And so, I mean, I went into extreme cognitive dissonance. So I accepted that Prabhupada's activities were perfect. I was just really struggling to understand them. So anyway, so Prabhupada reached down with actually the finger, sort of petting the kittens, and then he looked at me and said, "Just see, even here there is love." So he was talking about these kittens. These were, I mean, clearly subhuman living entities. And Prabhupada said, "Even here there is love." Then he said something very heavy. He said that because the kittens were just fearlessly rolling around in Prabhupada's lap, they sensed absolutely no danger from Prabhupada. Of course, there was none. Then Prabhupada said to me, "If I put my head on your lap and you cut my throat, that is the greatest sin." So anyway, of course, talking about also the exploitation, exploiting people who are under our care and so on. Now, Prabhupada's statement, "Just see, even here there is love." So, I mean, if you think of Arjuna's dilemma in the Bhagavad Gita, that he wanted to give up the act itself, and Krishna said, "Don't give up the act itself, which is born of your nature, give up a false state of consciousness which leads you to misinterpret the act. So, similarly, in an immature state of Krishna consciousness, like Arjuna, we tend to think that we have to give up the act itself. Or we may think that romantic love is somehow false and bad. But actually, the problem is not loving someone. The problem is mixing that love with a heaping tablespoon of vanity. In other words, in your presence, I feel like my body is gorgeous. Or I feel like I'm very... whatever. It's this self-centeredness. It's using what is ultimately the most beautiful, powerful part of God's creation, which is romantic love. Because that's the ultimate Krishna, who actually has the... obviously, he has the power and the money to do anything. And yet what Krishna chooses ultimately to do, his highest activity, his central activity, is romantic love. So Krishna himself affirms that the highest part of life is romantic love. And it's not our philosophy, actually, that romantic love is limited to two people, Radha and Krishna, and their plenary expansions, and everyone else is an eternal spectator. I mean, we certainly are. Certainly the highest ecstasy, the highest state of the soul, does come from appreciating and relishing the perfect love of Radha and Krishna. But what about Nanda and Yashoda? I mean, do they only ever shake hands? Or is it just like, it's just a business relationship? Well, Krishna needs a mother. Yes, and he needs a father. All right, so we'll... I mean, do Nanda and Yashoda really like each other? Or Vasudeva and Devaki, or other residents of the spiritual world. It must be the case that some cowherd boys have special friendship with some cowherd girls. But the point is, Prabhupada said that. Prabhupada said that in the spiritual world, people are not blind. They actually realize that the people around them are very good looking. And yet, because that's Krishna's creation. To be in the spiritual world and to completely ignore the fact that you're surrounded by extremely good-looking people would be to ignore Krishna's creation. To be blind to what Krishna himself has done. But the difference is that in the spiritual world, personal beauty or visible beauty is a manifestation of love of Krishna. And so there's so much love of Krishna that no one... That people do not get distracted or deviated by that love. So, going back now to Lord Chaitanya. So this amazing statement, ekatmanav, two souls as one. Api bhuvi pura deha vedam gatav, but pura in the past, they literally went to gatav. Tao, those two, Tao, Katao, literally went to Deha Veda, a difference of body. Or since time immemorial. That's literally what it says. Can we go back to the Sanskrit for text 5? Yeah. So that Deha Veda, Katao, Tao. In the second line, which is broken up. Tao means those two, Radha and Krishna. And Gatao means literally went or are existing in. Deha Vedam, a difference of body. Deha Vedam. Even though they are ekatmana, they are two souls, really one. If you think about this one compound word, ekatmana, is the essence of romantic love. The essence of romantic love is not lust. The essence of romantic love is two souls existing as one. So there are two souls. This is really Veda Veda. They are two souls, but they're somehow one. Ekatman, so this is Of course, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Chaitanyakyam, known as Chaitanya, Prakatam, manifest, Aduna, now, Tadvayam. So Tadvayam means that couple. Dvaya means two. This is like an English, dual. That dual, in other words, that couple. Tadvayam, that couple, cha and aikyam, oneness. Aikyam is from the word ekam. That couple, aptam, has now assumed oneness. It's a couple. So this beta is just filling this verse. It's ekadmanal, is itself an incredible statement of beta. And the couple has now achieved oneness. Tadvayam chaikim aptam radha bhava dyuti suvalitam nomi Krishna Sarupam. I bow to Krishna himself, Krishna Sarupam. It's really Krishna, but adorned with suvalitam, duty, the splendor, bhava, and the emotions of Radha. So this is this spiritual, materially achintya fact of the oneness and difference of Radha and Krishna. In this one verse, the fact that Radha and Krishna are one and different is stated in many ways. And now going back to text 6, can we look at the Sanskrit for text 6? So Krishna, it's interesting because we talk about achintya, veda, veda, tattva. Krishna himself is actually pondering this wonderful relationship. Krishna himself is pondering this extraordinary relationship between himself and Radharani, and is posing to himself a series of questions that he will answer by actually appearing in this world as Lord Chaitanya. All these, like Kidrusha, what is the greatness, what is the glory of the love of Sri Radha? And what is she relishing? And what is the sweetness she sees in me? What is the happiness? What kind of happiness does she experience? Now, one question is, Krishna is technically omniscient. Krishna is omniscient. Krishna knows everything. And yet he's asking himself questions. So, of course, we could just say these are pastime questions. He really knows the answer already. But he's just playing as if he doesn't know the answer. And, or you could say there's, even though Krishna's omniscient, there is some sense in which these are actually serious questions. So, I mean, in what sense could it be the case? Because here we have Krishna asking questions, and yet Krishna, there's no ignorance in Krishna. It would be absurd to say that in God there is ignorance. It's stated everywhere in the Bhagavatam that there is no ignorance in Krishna. There's absolutely no ignorance in Krishna. Now there's another statement in the Bhagavatam that Krishna is always expanding. So, I mean, again, we can use an analogy. Imagine the experience of someone falling in love. So let's say they meet a person and they exchange the relevant information, of course by email. And sometimes actually by personal conversation. So imagine a relationship like that where the two people actually, on one level, they know each other. They know each other's names. They know each other's families. They know each other's natures and moods. So that you can say they really know each other. But even though they really know each other, at a certain point, they get to know each other better. Or at a certain point, their love increases if they're still on, you know, in that part of the graph where the love is, where the love is increasing. So, the point is that even though they already know each other, there's no ignorance in their relationship, and yet they can fall more deeply in love and actually just discover more intense, more expansive understanding and emotion. So there's a sense in which Krishna already knows everything. It's not that he learned something he didn't know, but even Krishna himself, according to the Bhagavatam, has ever deeper experiences of his own glories. And therefore, without there being any ignorance in Krishna, Krishna being fully omniscient, he could actually seriously ask these questions and appear as Srimati in the mood of Radharani and actually experience ever more deeply what he already knew. That's one point. And the last point I want to make, so we probably should tell people that the class will end sometime, because otherwise people could actually have panic attacks and think the class may not end. So one question, which I think is an interesting question, assuming that, well, it is said that Krishna came to this world as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu because he wanted to experience Radharani's love. Now, in one sense, there's absolutely no reason for Krishna to come to this world to experience that. The spiritual world is not crowded. There actually, there's lots of space there. And surely Krishna could find some, you know, unused portion of the spiritual world. He could get in a reservation. And he could use that. So Krishna, in the spiritual world, could appear as Chaitanya. In fact, Prabhupada said he does. There is a section of the spiritual world where he does appear as Lord Chaitanya. So why, in other words, the desire to experience Radha's mood does not mean in and of itself that Krishna has to come to this world. The next point is that even if Krishna decided for some reason to have that experience in this world, why come in the Kali Yuga? Why experience the most intimate, the most confidential emotions in the most degraded age? In the most degraded age. The answer, I think, is quite simple. And that is, the reason Krishna chooses to come to this world to have that experience, and the reason he chooses to come to this world in the most degraded age, is because it's actually Krishna in the mood of Radharani that doesn't kill all of the losers of this age. This is really the loser yuga. If you consider that when Krishna came as Krishna, there were a lot of people that suffered body changes. Just Jarasandha alone, who probably the all-time world record for military recruitment. Every time he came to attack Krishna Mathura, he had 23 Akshohinis. That's like millions and millions of people. Somehow he went back and raised another army. So just huge numbers, tens of millions of people were removed from the planet. And yet in Chaitanya Leela, there's actually not a single person killed. And what is that, the Gopinath Patanayaka? He's almost executed by someone else and doesn't. I mean, the most violent Chaitanya Leela ever gets is just bopping a Buddhist on the head with a tray. What? Yes. Oh, yes. True. So, the reason Lord Chaitanya is so merciful, Namo Mahabhada Nyaya, and so on, is because in the mood of Radharani. It's actually the tender compassion of the supreme female. So there is a direct relationship, because sometimes we heard in the past that when Lord Chaitanya goes out to preach, it's Narayan in him preaching or something. But anyway, don't worry about that. The idea is that it's because Krishna's in the mood of Radharani that we're all still here. That's why we're still here, and that's why we're all getting second, third, fourth, fifth, and, you know, 2,300th chances. And It's because of that Krishna's in the mood of Radharani. So really that extraordinary mercy of Lord Chaitanya is the, and that's what is the mood of Radharani. That's why Krishna comes in this age to this world as Radharani. So that he's experiencing internally what he wanted to experience. At the same time, in the mood of Radharani, he's saving all of us. So, I'll stop here. Any questions on these points? Yes.
You were talking about...
Do we have another microphone or just... Or no? No?
How Krishna is asking these questions of himself. And how can this be? And I thought in the past, and I wanted to hear your opinion, that although Krishna is all omniscient, all powerful, all of these things, that he, of his will and power, actually gives that up.
Really?
That he gives it up, he surrenders his control over his, what happens to him, to Yogamaya, who arranges all of these things to happen. That he's, it's not that he knows it's going to happen. He actually, because he is all powerful, he has the power to give up his power for his enjoyment. And I, this is just my thought, and I wanted to hear your, if you think that that's totally crazy, or maybe there's some scriptural basis for it.
Krishna does, for example, sometimes let his coward boyfriends win wrestling matches. So, I mean, there is, if you think about it, if you think of a loving parent or father, say, wrestling with his child, his son, and the child sort of, you know, throws the father down and gets on top of the father. I mean, I don't mean a teenage son who's actually injuring his father, but... When you're a kid, when your sons get to a certain age, you don't have to let them beat you up. So they can do it by themselves. But if you imagine a father with a young child, and they're—I mean—they're actually enjoying, isn't it? And they're actually having a great time. So, as far as Krishna not really knowing, or—I mean—we know that Krishna enters into all kinds of intimate relationships where he's not. He's not using all of his power. He's just playing with his devotees. So I'm not sure if that would be different from what you said. You mentioned that he really doesn't know what's going to happen. I mean, if we think about it, then I'll say one more point. There is what is... Let's think about the... Well, it's a common experience for non-devotees. All of you have to just try to think back to your past. The experience of going to a movie. When people go to movies or when people read novels, there is a common term that they suspend their disbelief. You walk into a movie theater, you sit down, the movie starts, and you're watching a movie. Now, if the person next to you says, "This is just a movie, those are just actors, that's not really happening, that person didn't really die." So when we suspend our disbelief, we know, like if for some important reason someone asks us, like, "Is this really happening?" We know it's not, and yet we enter into it. We voluntarily just enter into the story. Yes, I'm in Middle Earth right now. Or I'm in some galaxy far, far away. So in that sense, we could imagine Krishna entering into his pastimes and suspending his disbelief in a sense. Where Krishna really, as we would say, gets into it. He really gets into the pastime. And even though, I mean, imagine a like mother, father playing with a child and the parents really get into the story. Now obviously it doesn't mean the parents actually are unable to recall that they are the parents. Like, it's just like Prabhupada says, when there was need, Krishna would play as a child, but when there was need, he would act as God. If some demon attacked, Krishna wasn't bewildered. He knew that he was God. It's just like you're in a theater and you're into the story, here I am in Middle Earth. If suddenly, let's say, someone next to you needs medical attention, you can immediately snap out of it and just do the needful. So I think something like that could be an analogy, that Krishna suspends his own disbelief and just enters into the story the way we always do, but this does not actually eradicate his ultimate understanding. Yes?
Mark, would it be more accurate to say that he's giving up the control, but he's not giving up the knowing?
Well, Krishna, if you think about it, if you're wrestling with your child, a little child, and, you know, the children become frustrated if they don't get to win, and so therefore you let the child kind of get on top of you or something. So you're, I mean, you obviously have not given up your power or your ability, but you're just, yeah, you're playing in that way. So in that sense, Krishna, it's not that he actually like renounces his power, like, but you're playing.
Well, that
yes.
Famous verse, Chakvasu Dushta Rekita Raja Lakshmi, he gives up sovereignty over Lakshmi, and I'm being cursed by that Brahmin, Aryabhachasaya, because he out of mercy chases living entities and Bandai Mahaprabhu.
Yeah, he gives up Raja Lakshmi and royal opulence.
But yeah, so in this mode of renunciation, he's like, he's always saying to the devotees as Mahaprabhu, you know.
Can you hear back there?
No.
Can you speak a little louder?
As Mahaprabhu, you know, he wanted to go to South India, but he wouldn't go unless Subdhana okayed this and said, well, you have to take somebody. And, you know, he's like a puppet. He says, I'm a puppet in your hands. I'm just like you own me.
Yes.
So,
and of course,
this is the
yes, even ourselves, for example, if we are sort of healthy and intelligent, then we enter into, in our relationships, we enter into degrees of intimacy based on the trustworthiness of the person. As we know, getting into an inappropriate level of intimacy or trust, just trusting someone too much that wasn't really worthy of that trust, or sort of relaxing around someone that turns out you shouldn't have relaxed that much around them, causes trouble. And ultimately, when we're a little older and wiser, hopefully, and, you know, we survive many battles, relationship battles, then we learn to trust people and reveal our minds to people appropriately according to, you know, the other person. And so Krishna is, of course, perfect at this. So Krishna gives up control, you could say, or he puts himself under the certain devotees, but this is all very, very precisely calculated in the sense that Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Jejata Mam Prapadyante, as people surrender to me or as they approach me, Tam Sahi Bhajami, I precisely reciprocate with them. So Krishna puts himself under the control of devotees precisely to the degree that those devotees, even if they appear to be ordering Krishna, actually are under the control of their love for Krishna and are controlled by their pure desire to please Krishna. So it's a precise reciprocation. To the extent that I'm controlled by a loving desire to please Krishna, to that degree, Krishna himself puts himself under my control. So it's perfect reciprocation.
Do we like in Buddha Hari? Is there some term in the CC that devotees compete with Krishna? Who's going to do more service?
Devotees compete with Krishna for service. So, yes. Loudly, please.
The idea of devotees loving each other, there's a conflict in my mind with that, because I can understand we're supposed to have loving exchanges, but at the same time, it's sort of, I guess I've sort of adopted the idea that they're means to the end, that we love devotees because they're part of Krishna, and that ultimately the goal is to love Krishna exclusively.
Oh my God.
Not in an exploitative way that we see devotees.
No, but oh my God.
I'm not saying I necessarily feel that way. I'm just saying that's how I understand it.
First of all, we do love people because they're part of Krishna, but they are eternally part of Krishna. So when do we stop loving them? And I mean, it's natural in a family. In a family, you love all the members of the family. You don't say, "Well, sorry, I just have to love the head of the family and." I respect you as a human being, but so actually Prabhupada said here, okay, I got it. Prabhupada said that Krishna is more pleased when you serve as devotee. He's more pleased. If you think about it, if you're a parent and you see one of your children with real love and kindness helping one of your other children, that's actually more pleasing than if the child does something for you personally, isn't it? I mean, that's practical psychology. Krishna is more pleased when we love his devotees, because one of Krishna's supreme opulences is detachment. He has no selfish desire. He's not a jealous God. That's an interesting idea, the jealous God. So yeah, so Krishna, in the spiritual world, people love each other. They have... So the idea of the jealous God, or that we just gradually focus all of our love on Krishna. In fact, the impersonalist, Prabhupada said, take the guru, and after all, there are innumerable gurus. I mean, everyone that helps us in Krishna consciousness is acting as a guru. So Prabhupada said the idea of jumping over the guru, like, okay, you've helped me, bye, thanks, I appreciate it, I'm with Krishna now, so I'll probably never see you again.
So the reason there's a conflict is because I cannot actually, I mean, obviously I can't see Krishna, but I don't really feel like I can see Krishna except in the devotees. And I don't mean that in kind of a sentimental way, I literally mean that I just can't fathom it, I can only see that. Because
these
are live people that I can interact with, and I don't feel that ability. So,
is
that too far in the other direction to see only Krishna,
Krishna
only in the devotees?
Well, I'm sure that you see Krishna also in the temple, in the deity.
It's more of an idea than an actual.
Well, it's a great idea. How should I put it? As I said in an earlier lecture, the good news is that God is not a religious fanatic. And Krishna, in the spiritual world, although some people are still working on that one, so Krishna, in the spiritual world, people love each other. It's just a world where everyone basically loves everyone else. And some people have special affinities. Even in the spiritual world, there's variety. There's variety, and every soul is unique. And there are natural affinities. There are natural alliances. Even Prabhupada, we learn about the Vishaka group and the Radha group, isn't it? Chandravali. Sorry about that. I'm a little rusty on my Rasa Bhakti, but you better get back in touch with my Rasa Guru. So yes, there's the Chandravali. There's the Chandravali group, right? And Radharani. So there are groups, but the point is there's no material envy, there's no There's no material lust, but they're like real people. Sometimes we think spiritual worlds like sort of like these glowing things that are totally inconceivable. They're like real people. And guess what? It's like, you know, you're one of them. We may be, I mean, think about it. Think of these analogies. Like Prabhupada said, Prabhupada kept trying to get through to us. It's not that he said, it's not that when you go to the spiritual world you have eight hands or five noses or whatever. Right now, your experience of yourself as a person, when you experience yourself as an individual person, that is, to some extent, self-realization. When we become pure, it's not that we see ourselves as something totally different than what we are now. We are already experiencing ourselves, our real self, to some extent. If you think about it, when you're sick, this is the analogy, right? The disease of material existence. Lord Chaitanya says, Bhava Maha Davagni Nirvapanam, putting out the fire. So, when you're sick, your body's sick, it's not that you go into a con, unless you're like totally delirious with fever. And even then, actually, even in delirium, it has some relationship to the real world. Like in a state of delirium, it can be pretty crazy, but it's not absolutely different from real life. And when you're just sick, if you have a, you know, just sick to some extent, it's still you. It's still you. You're still experiencing yourself to a great extent. It's just that you're sick. And when you become healthy, you're the same person. You just are in a much better state of consciousness, full of vigor, full of energy, and so on. So, what we are now, that we are persons, we like to sing and dance, we have friends, we sometimes fall in love, or this or that, or we like, you know, we like, I mean, that's the real person. That is the soul. And when we become purified, we just do it much better. Free of lust, free of greed, free of vanity. So, I mean, the notion that when I become pure, I'll be something absolutely different from what I am now is sort of impersonalism. So, any other question? Yes, Radhika. Dasi. A little louder.
As aspiring devotee couples, how can we cultivate the relationship that you're talking about that's based on purity and becoming one, but not based on the bondage of life or trying to enjoy one another?
Right.
Conditions?
We have to include Krishna. It's like, good night, Devi. Good night, Prabhu. Good night, Krishna. We have to add Krishna, and we have to we should see each other, because exploitation can not only take place due to lust in a marriage relationship, it can take place in a guru-disciple relationship. A guru can, you know, I mean, what if, let's say, oh, thank you. Can I have a menu? What if, next is a menu. What if, if I take the position of a spiritual master, what if I still have a desire to be honored? Or what if I still get a little thrill out of controlling other people? You know, nothing too nasty, just your basic lording it over. So a guru, I can, as we were discussing in earlier classes, that I can try to control the disciples too much. Why? Because of my own impurities. I may try to exert too much control over them. Or I may utilize the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, see the guru as good as God, and, you know, keep reminding people of that. And the disciple also. I mean, there's disciples also. They sometimes it's like, okay, you're the father I never had, so I really want you to do all kinds of things for me. Sometimes disciples, there's a certain kind of letter that gurus get, which is sort of like, it's like autobiographical, and some people just write long, long letters over and over again talking about themselves. It's like, it begins, please accept my obeisances, and ends, your servant, and in between. And they see the guru as the ultimate sympathetic listener. So again, it's not that there shouldn't be dialogue, but it's like, you know, like I said, in the airplane movie, the guy that kept driving people to suicide by telling his life story. So in a guru-disciple relationship, on both ends, if there's impurity, there can be, you know, you can use other people as a temple president. Or as a GB, I mean, in every position, to the extent that we're conditioned, we can use that position to get something for ourselves and not really be thinking what's best for the other person. Because sex desire is the strongest material desire for most people, and there is some sexual attraction generally in marriages when they're not arranged. So in a sense, it's like when you go to a gym and there's different exercise machines. So in a sense, marriage is one of the most important exercise machines. Precisely because the intimate association of boy and a girl tends to bring out strong desires. Therefore, it's a wonderful opportunity to really practice Krishna consciousness. It kind of brings out our impurities so that we can deal with them. We can work with them. That's what the fire does to the butter. It brings out the impurities so you can scoop them off. So you sort of have to get out your little Grihastha scooper. And sometimes, for example, and of course, it's like the dualities. Krishna talks about the dualities. So the I am resisting a little rhyming thing with scooper. But anyway. But at the stage where attachment is very strong, we have to work on that. And as we know, attachment can turn to aversion. Or disappointment. Because since attachments aren't ever really satisfied, love can be satisfied, but not attachment. So then there's the disappointment, and then you have to work on that. Can I deal with this person purely when I'm feeling attachment? Can I deal with this person Krishna consciously when I'm feeling disappointment or even aversion? So though that, I think marriage really provides opportunities. It's like a whole little gym in itself with all kinds of little exercise machines. And that's really the purpose of it. The marriage sacrifice is a Vedic sacrifice. It's an opportunity to advance in Krishna consciousness. So if we see it that way, if we envision marriage, family life, as an opportunity to advance in Krishna consciousness, then we just have to work at it. I mean, not literally we. Yes, uh-huh.
Krishna is asking as though, you know, Lord Chaitanya
did not exist at a certain point, and only when these questions arose in Krishna's mind that he comes into being. Like Krishna takes the form.
Yes, yes.
At a certain point.
Yeah, it's like after all these, after all this infinite time, Krishna finally asked the question. We know that Krishna's pastimes tend to be cyclical. We hear about, you know, like there are different scheduled incarnations. And so we can say that from time to time, Krishna explores different aspects of love. So perhaps we'll stop here. Thank you all very much. Happy Gaur Purnima. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Thank you again, Maharaj, for giving nice seminar and for me.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, yes.